this one-day symposium. My name is Clara Bowles, and I'm director of the International Centre for Fine Art Research, which has helped to organise this day, although our organisation has been limited to water, teas and coffees. And in fact, Rebecca Fortnum and Mick Finch and the newly formed Pink Club are the real organisers of this day, and we're incredibly pleased that they have done so. It's one of two symposia, actually, over this long weekend. There's a symposium on Monday, which I think Rebecca Portman will also talk about. And it's really the whole paint club and the whole question of looking at the process of painting really emerged from, I think, a feeling across the university to look at painting as a sort of interrogative research process, but also, I think, to attend to the needs, the position, and the desires of the individual painter in and beyond the institution, and which has made me think a lot about my own interest in painting, of which I know much less than I do about any of the other arts, my own background being in performance and writing. But last night I was thinking about where my own interest in painting really began as an adult. And for me, it was very much going to live in America in the late 90s, the first time I'd been in a culture where I would say that painting really matters. That is the way that marks are organised on a surface. What painting says and does and how painting changes matters as a matter of real importance to the whole culture in a way that I sometimes feel has been lacking in British culture and I miss as somebody who came back to live here a couple of years ago. And so that makes me even more interested in the process of what's going on today. And at UAL, of course, as we all know, there are always many people here at every event that ICFA runs or I chair that I don't know. But the vibrancy of painting, historically and present, runs across all of the colleges. And for us at ICFA, I think, and for myself and Rebecca, who've been talking about painting and other things for a long time, it's part for me of understanding how it is that art thinks, that painting itself is very central to the question for me of how art thinks, that how art actually informs through its processes theory, practice and cultural change. And we are very committed to that at ICFA as well through initiating a series of publications called How Art Thinks, the first of which we're launching this evening. So that's my introduction and my small spiel. I'm going to hand over to Rebecca Portman to say more in a moment. And it just remains for me to say a couple of things about techs, breaks and loots. So, technically, we don't have mics today. The mics that are on the table are for the recording that we're doing. And we're doing two recordings. One is an archival recording that is still with a static camera. And one is with Felix, who's recording in order to make a short film of the whole process of today as well. So he'll be kind of following people around, I think, as well as standing here. Water, we've got water for speakers. We're having a break at 11 o'clock and a break at 1 o'clock, I think. There are lots of cafes around about. There's a Pret. If you go either to your left or your right at 11 o'clock, there are places to get water and tea and coffee. Loser, downstairs for men, upstairs for women. After the day, we're launching the book at the October Gallery, which we'll be selling copies of the book for £5. Special offer and today only. If you really can't get to the launch tonight, then we will slip you a book if you slip us a fiver during the course of the day. I have to say that's a very, very limited offer. And on that note, because it is a gorgeous publication, and on that note, I'm going to hand over to Rebecca Fortman.
Thanks, Claire. And I'd like to say thank you to Chris Rolls, who you probably all know, who's been, without whom it would not be possible, etc. And Felix is filming the event. If anybody doesn't want to end up in a video, could they make themselves known, or their faces known to Felix, so he can edit you out of the final film? So I'm going to sort of just contextualise today's event. I mean, this is very nice. It feels like a gathering of familiar faces, I have to say. And actually, on that note, I wanted to dedicate this day to the painter Rosa Lee, who many of you will know personally and others through her work, and she died last week. And I think it's really entirely appropriate that we remember Rosa today because she was such a vital force in discussing painting. And, within education and in her writing, and of course in her painting, and the painting landscape in this country is going to be much diminished without her. There she is at the Disparities Show in Coventry in 93. As you might now be aware, today's event is the result of a collision between two new ventures within the University of the Arts London. And firstly, I'd like you to tell you a bit about Paint Club, the provocatively entitled Paint Club. You know, it's like Fight Club. I decided to convene Paint Club, not least because although painting maintains its prevalence as an activity, as Claire has said, within the university, it's quite often felt to me that painting is a silent partner to the other activities going on within fine art research. And indeed, it's this stereotype that I believe this group will challenge. For the painters that end up teaching and studying at UAL seem far from dumb beasts. I wanted to find a way of scrutinising the array of approaches to and practices of painting in their magnificent diversity, and I think we'll get a sense of that breadth of approach in our conversations today. In fact, I know we will because I've had a sneak preview. I think there's signs that we're ready for these kinds of conversations. Last month, some of us here will have been at the Tate conference that my colleague Dan Sturgis organised, Painting and Its History, which was a fantastic event. And this post-RAE moment seems a good one to draw on some of the strands together and create a productive network, a forum for thoughts, ideas, and research through and about painting. So this is how we're currently thinking about the Paint Club. It is in its infancy. It'll be a research network, and it's going to be open to all staff, research students, and possibly other students at the UAL. Now, painting here is defined as an expanded field that relates to the specific history and tradition of painting. We might talk more about definitions of painting later, but I can't really go into it now. It's too big a subject. Our activities will publicly explore and debate what it means to research as a painter within the context of contemporary art practice. Whilst the forms of this research is practice, it's expected that these discussions will feed into discussions about the teaching of painting within the UAL. Additionally, we'd like to establish a network of affiliations with other institutions that have established interest in painting, both in the UK and worldwide. So the plan is to put on one or two events like this one a year, that really respond to the concerns and interests of the membership. Now, membership of this group is fluid, we hope, and different members will propose, fundraise, and organise research events, maybe exhibitions, presentations, and other related activities. We're going to hold planning meetings termly and by the core group, to which others are invited, or they might invite themselves, as appropriate. So one of the things we want to do is we want to have representatives from all the UAL colleges involved in the teaching of painting. So we've formed a core group at the moment, and you'll hear from them all today. And at the moment it's Jeff Dennis from Chelsea, Derek Harris from Wimbledon, Mick Finch from Central St Martins, and Dan Sturgis from Camberwell. So we want to get your views on this initiative later on. So there's a bit of time set aside in the programme to do that. So Paint Club's collaborator in this event is the How Art Thinks research project that's based at the International Centre for Fine Art Research. For those of you who don't know, ICFA is physically based at Central St Martins, but it's actually the centre for all fine art researchers within the university. And this day has come about at the invitation of Claire, the director. The project How Art Thinks has developed from discussions between Claire and myself about the usefulness and worth of the documents that emerge from artists' processes. Now, both of us, working independently as researchers over the years, have been involved in the fascinating activity of working with artists to elicit and analyse documentation and statements that speak of how art gets made. The How Art Thinks project aims to do several things. Firstly, it engages with artists to find creative ways to document and publish what it is they do. It also aims to analyse and reflect on these documents. Secondly, it has an interest in artist narratives because what we've realised is that how artists speak about what they do actually helps shape their future production. This project focuses critical attention not on the finished products of an art practice, but instead on the transitory and the ephemeral, the words and evidence of processes. So for me, as a researcher, this is an extension of the work that I've been doing on Visual Intelligences Research Project, which is at the Lancaster Institute of Contemporary Arts at Lancaster University. And that project was involved in examining artists' thinking and making, and crucially, the relationship between their thinking and making. And this naturally led to discussion of documentation. How do you document what it is that artists do? So there have been a couple of symposia about that. And also, probably most interestingly for me, we've set up projects actually working with artists, finding ways that are the right ways for each artist to preserve and document the ways artists make. And I'm actually just going to show you, if I can, I'm going to show you an example of this. So I wanted you to see the kind of specific, somewhere, it's here, here we go. Now this was a project that I did with an artist who's here today, Beth Harland, a painter. And it's an example of working with an artist trying to document their process. Here you can see a painting that took a number of weeks to make. This is an animation of it sort of arriving on the surface of the canvas. So we made this interactive tool. The user of this can decide how, after the animation, they can decide how they look at it. And this actually ended up in an exhibition called Inspiration to Order that was at Wimbledon and Winchester and in a school art gallery in California. In that exhibition, there were 10 artists, and you got to see their work, but you also could see documentation. If you wanted to, you could see documentation of how the work got made. And it was different for everybody. There was this piece, but there was also a film on the artist Michael Ginsburg in his studio, and various other things, sketchbooks, for example. I mean, as a curator, I wanted to be quite clear that this documentation didn't have to be seen when you were looking at the work, because I understood that for some viewers it made the work less autonomous. So there's something, and I think we'll talk about these ideas later, about what happens when you make process visible. So, for example, here you can see some of the reference material that the artist is using and how they actually, hold on, I'll show you this. It's quite here, this bit under landscape. You can see that part of the painting has come from the Giorgione painting. So you can see how the work was made, but you can also see the reference material. And you can choose how you interact with it. Okay, returning to how art thinks, just to tell you, Claire mentioned briefly there's the conference, it's an interdisciplinary conference at Kettle's Yard on Monday. And tonight, the launch of the book, which again Claire's already talked about. So I do hope you'll come to that. So I'd like to quickly go back to the fundamental question lurking over this project. Why examine artists' processes? What can it tell us that we can't get from looking at a finished work? And further, why get artists themselves to consider their own processes or make them available to other scrutiny? In his book, Aesthetics and Paintings, Jason Geiger discusses the fact that artists do not provide an infallible guide to the meaning of their work. He continues, even though artists' activity involves a wide range of practical and theoretical decision-making, artists are not in a privileged position to account or analyse the work. This is, of course, true. However, It has always seemed to me that artists should have a voice, perhaps even take a responsibility in, about, with, through the discourse that emerges from their practice. Because what artists can tell us about how art gets made may have a variety of uses. For me, an urgent use presents itself within the context of higher education research. For instance, a more detailed knowledge of painting methodologies might allow us to establish models for practice as research that are more appropriate to what we do than the ones we have inherited. But I also believe that once we've acknowledged the fact that intention is quite separate from meaning, a range of multivalent narratives can usefully attach themselves to visual production. As Geiger continues, one of the challenges in writing about painting is to remain sufficiently attentive to the specific goals that have motivated artists at different historical periods, while at the same time addressing fundamental questions that pertain not just to this or that artist's work, but to painting as such. And I'd say that this dual challenge is not only to be found in writing about painting, but in the act of painting itself. We are always, as painters, trying to reconcile what we hope we are doing with what we have done. Now, the painters that you're going to hear from today are all teachers at UAL, and they spend a good deal of time painting, probably not quite as much as they'd like to. But in many cases, an equal amount of time is spent talking about painting when they're teaching. Fundamentally, they operate as a maker inside the process, motivated by the specific goals, devising procedures or mechanisms to achieve them. But they also attempt to see the bigger picture, asking what Geiger might term the philosopher's questions about what painting is. I believe that in serious painting practices, process and product inform each other, and whilst the paintings may be visible, a more comprehensive articulation of process can often be had. As Professor Nigel Whiteley, who was the art historian and theorist who initiated the Visual Intelligence Research Project, and unfortunately he can't be here today because he's not very well, but as he'd said, I want to finish with a quote from him. He says, it's really about understanding something of the thinking that goes into making artworks, not at an old level of intentionality, but as ways of thinking and doing, tacit knowledge, really. The benefit that it gives us as historians and critics is a fuller understanding of why things look the way they do, not as an end in itself, but as one of the ingredients. What means we put it to is up to us. So I'd like now to welcome the first two speakers, and Vanessa Jackson, who will be the chair for this morning.
Chris? Hang on. Oh, no, we're okay. So, Jeff, just get it up. Just get it up first. It's just a second, Jeff.
It's,
just see if the resolution's...
Okay.
No, that's fine. Just have to write.
Yeah.
Which one to be?
Thank you. Okay. Good morning. I'm Vanessa. I'd like to introduce Geoffrey Dennis, who's going to read from his paper, and then after a short while, there will be a respondent from Katrina. So, Geoffrey, over to you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, everyone. Forgive me reading from some notes, because I feel if I ad-lib too much, I'll start to stray from the script, and then the timing will go hopelessly wrong. So I've got to keep on message here. I've entitled this short piece, The Painting That Is Better Than It Ought to Be. In a short email conversation with the painter Merlin James in 2005, which was part of my research for a small book I made that was about conversations about painting, we discussed the subject of intentions within painting. This arose from my having had the opportunity to look at the back of one of his paintings. It's actually the painting on the screen now. And turning it over, being able to see all the revisions, cuts, joins, renaming, relabeling, redating, and reorientating that he'd done. I was slightly shocked to see how long he'd been working on it. And in common with many of his paintings, this had been the case. It had been, almost 10 years. James's painting maintains a dialogue with source images that may already be in the public arena, like archive photographs, or it might be personal memorabilia. But it was clear that the artist did not have a straightforward path from idea to form. It would have been impossible to anticipate all the revisions that actually happened in the painting. This is something shared with my own practice. This is a reproduction of a recent painting, but it was worked on for many years. I didn't know that was going to happen when I started. It was just from a general sense of dissatisfaction with the way it looked. But it contains images that are derived from photographs from a children's storybook, from video images of things happening in my studio, and other things that gathered as the painting went along. And its visual appearance is very different from anything I could have planned in the first instance. Many of the connections between the things in the paintings are absolutely coincidental. The plastic fruit net from some fruit bought from a supermarket might actually end up looking a bit like the large red tube that's also in the painting, and may have a connection to the image of a father and son preparing a fishing net in Bangladesh. Was not something I had a strategy and plan for, but I welcomed those coincidental narrative, structural and apparent links as the painting developed. So in many other fields, at least in the more orthodox manifestations of them, I think such changes of direction and rethinkings would leave a project hopelessly compromised. If, for example, an architect allowed a building to be half built and then said, just a minute, I think I'd like to rethink the basement area, or perhaps we should move the service elevator from one end of the building to the other, or perhaps I'd like to turn the ground plan of the building around 90 degrees. He would face a walkout from the builders and financial ruin. The professional requirement usually is, number one, listen to the client's requirements. Number two, have a kind of vision about how to approach this. Number three, apply your expertise. And number four, execute. Painting, on the other hand, can be configured to encompass such changes. In the case of Merlin James's work and my own, there is this positive embrace of rethinks. The painting, by such reworking, can come to embody time in some form, a kind of compression of time within the lamination of a painting's thickness. If I say, I hope this painting turns out to be better than the ideas I've got that I'm going to put into it, does that sanction a kind of idiot's charter for painters? I hope not. If I set up the terms for a painting with sufficient flexibility built in, then I can feel okay about unexpected turns of direction. I think diversion is a useful word. It can describe a forced detour, possibly both from frustration and also offering a kind of opportunity, as when you're driving along and the looming orange cones are coming towards you on the motorway that signal the unexpected roadworks, and they leave the helpless motorist peeling away from the main road, so they find themselves hurriedly changing down in gear and driving past forgotten coaching inns. But it can also mean entertainment, a word that has a confusing and uncertain relevance when applied to the experience of looking at paintings or making paintings. It might seem to suggest the promise of fireworks, an all singing and dancing cast of performers, perhaps a light show. And there are paintings that I think almost succeed in delivering this. I've got one example of such up now from the show of a couple of years ago called USA Today, from the Saatchi collection. And there's another. Entertainment. To entertain a thought, however, means to engage with the implications of that thought, to run with it, turn it over in your mind. And in that sense, artists might ask people who look at their work to actually entertain the painting rather than the other way around, to engage with it, give it some time, consider its implications. If you believe, as I do, that there is a kind of quality in painting that results from open-ended, non-prescribed exploration of simply what might be the most interesting thing to see happen next within any painting, then there might be problems for the future of painting within the framework of practice-based PhDs, where a judgment of quality will always tend to be made against partly by measurement against the aims that were declared at the outset of the project. What if, for example, a research student should produce perhaps the most, almost by accident, perhaps on a day off from their proper research, some off-piste paintings of startling quality? They may face a difficult choice to set aside their original proposed outcomes, perhaps even to abandon their PhD, or to ignore these accidental but very good paintings as an irrelevant distraction and get back on message. Of course, sophisticated and sensitive supervisors, and here at the University of Arts, we all are, of course, can encourage a flexibility of development that can perhaps encompass their diversions and even encourage the student to play fast and loose with their original proposal. But less nuanced supervision may simply enforce some kind of dogmatic and plodding adherence to the stated outcomes. So on that note, I'll finish.
Thank you. And I think I'll let you,
Katrine,
yes. Straight into your...
So I have a sort of a response that I will sort of more or less read out as a sort of, almost like a reflection on what Jeff has been saying. So I can just go through...
Just get rid of those.
And I sort of wanted to make it into reflection partly because I make a lot of reflective work, so I thought I could sort of double up a little bit in that way. But also because the whole idea of reflection is becoming such a big sort of word, for instance, in teaching and learning at UAL through the PhD Cert, etc., and also through artistic research, reflection is often used as a method, building on the work of Donald Schoen, etc. But I was thinking of using somebody called John Cowan, and he he developed something called reflection for, in and on. In his case, it was for action in terms of teaching, but I was thinking of using it on painting. So reflection for painting. So I think there's something that happens before we start. And I want to sort of start by saying that result, reason and process cannot be reduced to each other in painting, but are codependent with a very unstable and unfixed interrelationship. And I think this instability is perhaps what creates that relationship between intentionality and potentiality that you started off by describing. So I was thinking, you know, in terms of that instability, how can painting be thought of in terms of research, as students now are undertaking research-based practice-based research in painting at UAL. And this is actually a serious question, particularly for this research network. But in a way, as a painter researcher, one always has to create some kind of fiction around what the process will involve in terms of aims and objectives. And if you are, as a painter researcher, this has to be stated quite clearly in terms of an outcome. But in a way, this fiction is in quite related to the kinds of conceptions and intentions that you have when you start to work on the painting anyway. Because it's, you know, all paintings that you make, they build on previous work. There is no tabula rasa. There is previous ideas, previous work, successes, failures. And I think that what's maybe different about painters is that they feel a sense of confidence about letting go of their intentions and ideas somewhere along the line. From actively encouraging chance and accidents, which is the process of some artists, to more tentative, just a slackening of the reins and a willingness to enter into a very dialogic production mode, which is more perhaps like a process of negotiation. Sometimes it's a process of abandonment, but more often as a process of adjustment and shifts in this dialogue with process and materials. So there's a, in fact, there's a reflection in action in terms of the painting. There's a reflection in the painting. So I'm also interested in the process of painting as not just the moments when you are actually painting, but as a process that's much more encompassing. And as a sort of as a method, then method, it can perhaps be transferable or reapplicable to other, both to other ways of making art, but also to other forms of what we might loosely call knowledge production. And the danger here, perhaps, is to romanticize this process or to ring-fence it as being completely unique to painting, which I do not believe is either necessary or productive. But what I think maybe painting allows better than many other art forms, bias there perhaps, and other forms of communicating meaning, is a form of thinking that's, because it's highly visual, it's materially based, it's also tactile, it can operate, it sort of can circumvent logocentricity, it can sort of go outside of language in some ways, even if language can never be fully escaped, etc. But it can, in some instances, sometimes, it can escape the limitations that being word creatures who speak, those limitations on our thinking, at least in the sort of spoken, written sense of language. And instead, there's a different kind of language in operation, a language that also has limits, and which is linked to education, visual literacy, class, culture, all these things, but which are still perhaps more individual than our shared language like English. But this is, you know, speculation. I'm not particularly interested in the genius painter who does not speak, who works in isolation, in some kind of mystical communion with their work. But I'm very interested in ways to talk of visually based knowledge, ways of making meaning that's new, but that is also heavily informed and made possible by the history of a particular mode of image making, in this case, painting. And that is perhaps in this area we can think of painting as quite privileged as a language because it goes back so far. And this is also perhaps why we can never look at or to use Jeff's idea of entertain a painting without also considering all that's come before and all that may come after. So from that sort of from there, I'd like to sort of state an interest in the process of painting as having the potential to be, in some ways, an applicable method, not in a literal sense that I would like to, you know, to try and develop a fixed methodology, but as a speculation of what painters have to offer what we might call the research community, particularly in art, but hopefully also outside of art and design. And I'm myself currently doing a PhD, which is not actually in painting, but painting informs the work and certainly the process of the work. My painting practice now is in parts right at the borders of what might be called a painting. But from this point, it is increasingly clear to me that the process of thinking and making, the function of conception and forming my work, even in, or particularly actually at the moment when it's the writing of the PhD, is fundamentally what I would call painterly. I collaborate with architects and other artists who are not painters, and in these processes I get a very clear sense that the way that I structure a process, the way that I trust process, and the way that for me going off tangents is not about a lack of rigour, but or some kind of weakness or inability to stay focused, but actually a necessary part of the process. So it's the sort of event of the work, a sort of performing of the process and trusting this. And I think that this in itself can also be seen as a one kind of rigour. I think there's case to be made that there are many kinds of rigour. Well, maybe this has happened because I trained as a painter, so things got wired up in a particular way. But, or maybe I was drawn to this way of, drawn to painting because it was already like that. But I certainly believe this approach can be learnt and can be applied to other areas. And I feel that I'm being more painterly when I, at the moment, I'm being more of a painter when I write than when I'm painting. So this is finishing off sort of reflection on painting, and the slide that you see here now is a quite recent painting which, as it can be said to be pre-designed, it's designed on a computer, it's laser cut, and it's painted with a commercially produced household paint. It could be said to be as far removed from notions of detours and accidents as you can get. And yet, despite all these attempts at predetermining all aspects of the process, the outcome was still a surprise to me, and to entertain it, again, in Jeff's sense, it was actually completely contingent on its installation.
I love the way you've included a new Davenport just as a reference to show how large yours is.
Yeah, it's a small painting. but it's actually, as a thing, as a painting, I think it's inert. It's not actually doing anything until it's installed. And it's in that moment of actually interacting with the space and potentially with an audience that it has this moment to try and escape predetermined ideas and overprescribed attentions, and hopefully something else can happen. And I'm going to finish off by showing a slide of a work by a colleague of ours at Chelsea, Natasha Kidd, who's here today. And she's given me permission to show this. And as part of her practice, she makes painting machines, and as such can be seen to really remove herself from the actual process of painting as far as you could get in some ways. And going back to the idea of research in art, these machines almost mimic a positivist research model. They can even be seen as controlled experiments, which can be repeated and falsified by anyone by using this machine. However, the outcomes are not at all the same. Some are more actually interesting than others, the actual paintings that are being made. They seem to work better. However, by making these distinctions, by saying that this is, you know, better or more interesting, what is it that is happening? What are we doing at that point? These canvases with different formations of paint, they just are in a way. They could even be seen as some kind of byproduct of a process. In fact, the work of art may be seen as being only the operation of the machine, with the paintings as a sort of form of documentation at the end. But however, the paintings themselves, they, I think, defy that. So this work for me signals two things that I want to stress here. One is that paint itself, even when it's as far removed from, when it's white emulsion in the case that it is here, which is very far removed from Elkin's notion of sort of seductive alchemical oil paint as we can get. Even so, repeatedly, it's as a material, it's repeatedly capable of taking intentions on a detour in itself. So the material of paint colludes, resists, undoes, and forgets. And that secondly, to literally or metaphorically step back at times and let painting do its job can be used as a strategy in and possibly outside of painting.
Thank you. I wonder whether you don't wish to respond back now, because then there's a kind of a two-way response. but I would just ask, I suggest that there's something implicit in the whole notion of the event that you're both talking about, but in very different ways. And I think it's also to do with experimentation, but it's where that experimentation is seen and how that's then given and where it's set up, whether it's set up right from the beginning in the studio, whether it's the thing that only comes to life when one sees it in the, actually in the public domain, whether we're allowed to see the experiment, and of course, looking at Natasha's work, we're seeing all of those things at the same time. And there's a big question for me about the word that's constantly used, it'll be used all day, and it's called image. Because the minute you say image, then presumably that means that there's always this thing that comes first, is brought in to begin with, whatever else happens to it. But I'm sorry, I don't want to take over. Do you want
just to respond to what you said about event, I think that is a really interesting word, because Natasha's painting bucks the usual trend of when you go to see paintings, it's kind of like all the action's already happened. It's like a football supporter turning up at the ground 5 minutes after the match is finished, and you're looking at the aftermath of something, which obviously isn't the case in kids' painting. But I think the event is an exciting word as well, which I often find myself using in teaching. You can see the way someone that might have set up the terms for a painting. I'm going to use these ingredients or colours, or it's going to follow these procedures. But you still find yourself sort of sitting back and waiting for the actual event in the painting. And if that doesn't happen, somehow there's a feeling that the painting has fallen flat.
We have about sort of just over 5 minutes in which we could ask if anybody would like to ask questions. If you do, I'm going to have to repeat your question, so keep it very simple, because we haven't got enough mics to go around. So if anybody would like to ask a question of either Jeffrey or Katrina, or we can keep on talking amongst ourselves.
It's very early in the day.
It is. We have a little black coffee.
I think it's a point of observation. I think it's really interesting, Katrina, you're talking about perhaps the difficulties of talking about work that's made, in a kind of intuitive way, in a art institution.
Okay.
Actually, how you might frame that.
I have to repeat you into the... Yes. So the difficulties of being working in any intuitive way.
Yeah, I mean, the difficult... How you talk about it in an art institution, I think it's really just an observation that I find sometimes quite problematic, and also how you actually... how you help or assess the student or, the friend or whoever.
So working within an institution in an intuitive way, that's the nub of the dilemma. Sorry, would you like to?
I agree that this is a constant issue. This is sort of it's an issue for students, it's an issue for teachers, and it's an issue certainly in terms of research and the sort of rigorous process that's supposed to go through. But I think it's our job to kind of find ways of allowing it to operate so that it becomes a valid method. And I do know that some people who are writing PhD now are using intuition as a method, sort of stated method towards studies.
And also I think that relationship is always going to embody tension. That there are all, I think, good colleges, good art schools, good universities need and implicitly encourage a critique from within. So there'll be always people sort of bashing against the limits and trying to sort of circumvent the established ways of doing things. And if that wasn't going on, there'd be something missing.
Thank you. But does that also mean that there has to be that that's happening within the relationship between what is might be seen to be what you do in your studio and what you do as a teacher?
I think trying to trip yourself up in terms of your own painting is something I'm quite keen on doing, and also the notion of play. I think you can set up the terms for a kind of painting. You think now I'm doing my work and I am painting, and I do it like this. Mm-hmm. And then there's an interesting flip in your mind that happens if you say, well, okay, now it's playtime and I'm going to do things another way. And that led me, for example, to start making some three-dimensional paintings, mm-hmm. where I had to think, well, this doesn't work like my usual paintings. What happens when I turn this corner and go around it? So it's something that doesn't comply.
I was just thinking about your comments on how an architect can't change his plans as he goes along, and how you were saying how long the Merlin James painting took. And I thought, I wonder what you think about rephrase that to a much longer period of time. An architect can, of course, knock down material walls, reconvert a building and conservatory.
Yes,
Yes, do you want to do it?
So the question was, the example I chose of an architect changing, not being a, being less able to be flexible in a project. And of course, as soon as you think of an example like that, as I did, you think of all the exceptions to that. And I still think it's an interesting comparison, but if you compare the life of a building rather than the life of one architect's projects, I think you have more of an interesting comparison with how a painting might work. Mm-hmm. That a building might, over its own history, take many, who knows, this building we're in might have very many different functions and have bits added on and taken off and changed. So it outlives the expectations with which it was designed, and that doesn't quite answer your question.
Well, that's also the importance of time that you put to the your phrase, the laminations, the lamination of a painting's thickness. I mean, that is time and practice itself, isn't it? So that sort of that seems important to your practice, but also to that idea of. That the experience is something which is coming through that. It can't possibly come any faster. I do have to kind of call a halt. Sorry, it was very good. And I'm sure you two must have a lot of conversations which are not always so polite. So maybe later on we can have them.
Right.
But thank you very much.
Thank you.
Because we're not aware of the fact that, of course, these are not microphones, these are for recording. They're not really for tannoying out there. So we will try to speak up, okay?
Yeah.
And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mick Finch, who's one of the coordinators of this from Centre St Martin's, and his, I'm going to call you co-respondent, but I don't think that's quite the right word.
Co-pilot,
or whatever. Mario Rossi. So, first of all, Mick, over to you.
Okay, as Jeff said, we just to explain a little bit of the process before we got here, you'll be hearing a lot of references to James Elkin. I can't remember the name of the book, but he comes, that's it, yeah, it comes into these presentations quite a lot. It comes into mine. So it's a sort of it's a stalking horse for a lot of these papers. I'm going to read as well. We're trying to keep these to 10 minutes, so excuse the process if it's a bit wooden. And it's quite telegraphic. If you are interested in reading it later, I've posted it on my website, so if you want to unpack it later, you can. Anyway, so I'm gonna read mainly. It's called Painting as Tableau, Tableau as Process. James Elkin's book, What Painting Is, acts both as a primer and a stalking horse for this symposium. Elkin's book is specifically about the act of oil painting as driven by touch and gesture, an elemental condition where he says paint is water and stone, and it is also liquid thought. The image of the painter evoked by Elkin's is easily recognisable as a central and stock character of popular culture, the mercurial, passionate figure, an alchemist conjuring elemental forces. Frederick Jameson, in his essay, The Deconstruction of Expression, famously and similarly mobilises an image of the painter close to Elkin's in the form of Van Gogh through the example of his painting Peasant Shoes. However, this chimera is conjured in order to create a contrast and to displace it with Warhol's Diamond Dust Shoes. The shift in mode of production in Jameson's analysis is away from the depth model of representation, marked by what he calls the waning of effect. He says what replaces these various depth models is, for the most part, a conception of practices, discourses, and textual play. Suffice it merely to observe that there are two: depth is replaced by surface or by multiple surfaces. What is often called intertextuality is, in that sense, no longer a matter of depth. I'm going to consider this latter model of intertextuality and surfaces as opposed to a depth model in talking about painting here, less as an act as such, but rather as a complex compound of practices. The perspective here is that to narrowly mobilise gesture touch as the principal model of painting, as Elkin's discussion suggests, is to preclude a contemporary, more complex understanding of it as a meta-practice. Here I would say that the binary of a flatness depth model of painting, which is specific to an Anglo-American post-war context, is useful to contrast with the peinture tableau model of how painting has been thought through in other discussions, most notably Hubert Damisch's Le Fanette Cadmium Jeune and in Michael Fried's Manet's Modernism. This can be brutally understood as a distinction between the act of painting, its basic materiality, and the handling of paint, a more complex sense of painting as an object, and the schema and mechanisms of representation which subtend it. And one thing I would say, especially with just as an aside, with the example of Damisch, is that one of the aspects of an idea of tableau, certainly in French paintings, is this distinction between flatness and thickness. It's a very fundamental distinction which Yves Alain Barre used in his book from the 90s, Painting's Model. And it's an example of this distinction is a purely painterly reading of Titian's Flaying of Marsyas. Marsyas that privileges the virtuosity and distinctness of the handling, a reading that in the 1980s was used to promote a neo-expressionist return to painting. This reading of the moody, painterly late work of a great artist obscured the more robust analysis of late Titian in terms of a material interpretation of Ovid, where shallow space and fluid brushwork lend itself to themes of metamorphosis. This material interpretation could be said to be at the level of its status as tableau. Similarly, Foucault's essay on Las Meninas in Les Mœurs et les Choses concentrates upon its qualities as tableau, as a total composition the structures the spectators experience of the work at a number of levels, and not as a virtuoso performance by Velázquez. A more contemporary example can be derived from Gerhard Richter's Betty, especially as it is often exhibited in close proximity to one of Richter's dark grey glazed monochromes. The painting is actually after a photograph of Betty, who is simultaneously faced with both her reflection in the glazed painting and the work itself. These mediations between the materiality of photography and painting, in terms of mechanisms of looking and reflexivity, add up to a dispositive of spectatorship within the realms of the work's status as tableau, and which predominates over other readings, however skillful or achieved the handling of a painting is as facture. This example of Richter raises the question of his relationship to images in general and to the archive that serves his practice. Richter's Atlas has become a thing in itself and demonstrates his relationship to mediation of images, both as photographs taken by himself, by other people, or appropriated from the wider media. The relationship in itself is one of the motifs of the series October 18, 1977, where images taken by the Baader-Meinhof group themselves, the forensic images and the journalistic photographs, open up the discursive spaces of the images. The production here is arguably akin to a syntagmatic structure, where rhetorical and syntactical aspects of image are at work, and where embedded codes that fuel models of communication are being mediated. Richard Prince uses such relationships to image as a foundation for his wider practice. Like Warhol, Prince is not strictly a painter. His practice occupies a space of intertextuality and meta-practice. The images he collects and organises into his gangs, taxonomies which are central to his work, often culminate in paintings as diverse as the text gag lines, the nurses, or the car hoods, which are like symbolic monochromes, in a sense. The spacing of the image that Prince manipulates in the gangs and Richter and Atlas brings to mind a relationship to Warburg's pathos formula. Warburg's concept is most evident in the planche he used late in his life to demonstrate the iconographic movements and relationship between works, particularly in the migration from the pagan to the Renaissance. Such iconography was already, by the 1920s, at work in the wider culture as the photographic image became increasingly material to public space, consciousness and ideological formations. This points to processes of appropriation, retranscription, and recontextualization at work in a contemporary context, which have arguably always been at work, as alluded to in the early example of Titian. As Duchamp said, the word art, etymologically speaking, means to make, simply to make. Now, what art is making? Making something is choosing a tube of blue, a tube of red, putting some of it on the palette, and always choosing the quality of the blue, the quality of the red, and always choosing the place to put it on the canvas. It's always choosing. So in order to choose, you can use tubes of paint, you can use brushes, but you can use a ready-made thing, made either mechanically or by the hand of another man, even if you want, and appropriate it, since it's you who choose it. Choice is the main thing, even in normal painting. The point I'm making here is that a sous-sol of process, at the level of painting as tableau, are increasingly determining questions of materiality, composition, execution, presentation, and a hybrid relationship to technologies in terms of medium specificities that can be understood as painting. In addition, for painting, a so-called expanded field is arguably at work in terms that predate Rosalind Krauss's lucid application of the term to sculpture. The ground upon which abstraction was invented within the space and practice of painting, and where collage and montage also appear, signal an idea of an expanded field that throws into question recent explorations of the genre simply in terms of a literal, painterly colonization of three dimensions. Expansion, signaled by painting's modernist past, points to its relationship to the discursive spaces of photography, film, and to the frontiers between medium and objecthood, which can also be expressed as painting working at the level of the tableau. To borrow another term from Duchamp, this can perhaps be thought of as an infra-thin space where the hand of the artist is barely present or has retreated completely or where the structuring of the work depends upon wishes hidden, was obscured or effaced. I'm just going to run through briefly some examples of what this infra-thin sort of tableau process might be, with just five examples. One being Simon Hontai, an artist who mainly made his career in France, who folds the canvas and then crushes the canvas together and then puts paint on, then unfolds. There's a volumetric relationship using the pliability of the surface, which he also did in these very meticulous grids. And this sense of like the relationship of the surface to thickness at that point, its materiality in producing the image, is something which was very embedded in the kind of thinking that came out of the 50s with painters like Hontai. Also Deserves, Daniel Deserves, in his Echelle de Bois, it's a kind of unrolling grid structure. He was part of Support Surface in the late 60s, early 70s. Also part of that kind of, it was barely a group, but configuration of artists was Deserves, who uses tressage, so he would cut up two canvases and then weave them together. And Lacan wrote a famous essay about these paintings called Le Port, where he's talking about the fact that you're looking at something where half of what is there you can't see. And this interested him a lot. And a younger generation in France, Dominique Figuerella, who makes paintings, he makes these puddles on the, or pools of paint on the canvas, then photographs them. This is another painting with the same process, and then cuts the image out and lays it into the painting. So it's a sort of mise en abîme, using the reflective and mirror-like qualities and the states of the painting. And also Christopher Wall, with I think he's strangely linked to this thing I'm trying to think of here, where there's a sense of effacement that's going on. We'll stop.
Okay. Thank you, Mick, for such a rich, highly discursive, and if I may say so, densely layered paper, which I must admit has presented me with somewhat of a challenge, not in the least to respond in 5 minutes. Anyway. I think we broadly agree that the quote from James Elkins reveals somewhat a limiting definition of painting, and that it applies an interpretation that simultaneously excludes a swathe of pre-modern, advanced, and more nuanced approaches. The term gesture itself in relation to painting is somewhat vaguely defined in general. I make a distinction between the standalone modern gesture and the depictive haptic gesture, which is dominant between Titian and post-impressionism, and which has some seepage at either end, continuing into the present and finds its material apotheosis, to my mind, during the Rococo, in the combination of the frivolous subject and the super-quick wrist action of Fragonard, a precursor to Warhol's fascination with surface. So either we can conclude that this stylistic trope is an irrelevance for painters today, which it evidently isn't, given Glenn Brown, David Reed, Cecily Brown and John Curran, or that what is being suggested by Elkins is a specific kind of painting that identifies a point with subject and medium, not necessarily image and medium, interfuse, and I think that's something that interests both of us. However, I'm not sure we arrive at this point via the same route. So if I may return to the phrase, not strictly a painter, which you use in relationship to Richard Prince, as it seems to reveal the matter of thresholds. What does it mean to be strictly a painter or not strictly a painter? Where do we draw the line, and does it really matter anymore? I've never considered myself to be strictly a painter, and yet your paper makes me wonder if I am stricter than I previously imagined, or if I am indeed not being strict enough.
You know you're strict.
What I distill from what you have compellingly set out for us, and perhaps I'm oversimplifying it, is the opening up of the potential of the language of painting based not only on, or not even on, the trace, the gesture, or the depth model, but a more self-conscious approach along the lines of Arthur Danto's post-conceptual art suggestion, that the momentum of art has shifted from the historical development of form to a model of philosophical self-consciousness, raising the challenge and resulting in new possibilities of painting by questioning its own foundations. You provided examples of meta-practices that elaborate painting significance through embedding meaning in process, performativity, and engagement with archive. And then there are the not very strict at all painters, the ones who play fast and loose with painters' tropes, Art and Languages, portraits of Lenin in the style of Jackson Pollock, Richard Prince's jokes, Andy Warhol's piss paintings, and Martin Kippenberger's almost everything. And yet, which is the perpetrator and which is the victim of these incursions? As this endless interrogation of the limitations and failures of painting paradoxically continues to provide a reinvestment in painting significance. The relationship is partly what David Reed's vampire paintings, which we showed earlier, allude to, and what Michel Serres in his book The Parasite identifies through his exploration of the relationship of the host and the parasite, which he describes as a kind of middling milieu, the complex, symbiotic mingling necessary for recovery, productivity, and vibrancy, and all aspects of exchange. And in effect, it's an attack on all manners of boundaries and thresholds. At least this was the story up until fairly recently. Alain Bois, drawing on Damisch, compares the discourse of painting in its episodic moments on the model of game and match, the game of painting in each period of revival as a match. Personally, I think this paradigm is no longer of much use, as we seem to have shifted from the episodic to a more atomistic and heterogeneous mode of engagement with art practices. The question hasn't been for a while whether the game's over, it's just that the goalposts have shifted, along with a lot of other coordinates, not least of which is the digitalisation of the image and the communication in general. In addition, I suspect it's also a result of the expanded and multiple layers of the art world and the sense that legitimation comes from a far broader horizon. In relation to the conceptualisation of painting as tableau, I would like to add a few more possibilities. The exploration in relation to context and social spaces outside of the gallery. Daniel Bourain, a contemporary of Support Surface, and who, to my mind, represents a more radical and perhaps urgent position in relationship to painting, is a precursor of this, although I'm sure he might not agree. But I'm also thinking of Thomas Lawson's tarpaulin paintings and the building scaffolding that were erected on building scaffolding as they were being renovated. Andrew Carney's site-specific museological documentary constructions and Rudolf Stingel's interplay between painting, private and public space, and audience interaction. These are modes of painting that engage audience, registers of visibility at the level of intervention. The second is what Jean Verwoerd describes as the strategic situative staging, painting put to work in a broader dynamic with video, photography and installation. Jack Goldstein explored the thresholds of these elements and pointed to the potential overlap, but more recently Anton Henning, Adrian Patchy and Franz Ackermann, amongst others, have brought them together within a rich mix of references. These artists might be said to reflect the disjunctions and contradictions of the moment and enlist painting from the position that the internal dialogue and its episodic trajectory is complete, preferring instead to allow it fully formed with all its attendant nuances, both in relation to process and image, to play out as one component within a non-hierarchical matrix. In short, to be itself. Another possibility that interests me is the space that Rongsia calls the meeting place between artistic and political practices, where art takes over the territory, vacuated by more traditional political spheres. I've become increasingly interested in this space, not only in relationship to painting, but in the breadth of my own practice. Certainly the Strangers to Ourselves curatorial projects that I co-instigated picked up on this in 2001, and since then, in relation to issues of displacement and re-territorialisation, it is clear that political institutions still lack the will or productive mechanisms of response. While the debate seemed to have gravitated towards global art biennales, including Documenta and the forthcoming Manifesta, the question I've been asking is how can painting engage with these issues that become the accepted territory of lens-based or documentary practices? And it is in response to this that terms like image, affect, empathy and subjectivity begin to re-emerge as tools for engaging with politics across the boundaries of public and private, citizen and individual. From my own perspective, I no longer think there's anything to be gained from positions in relation to legitimacy. I think that what is at stake now has to be in the realms of placing practice in a vulnerable, uncomfortable position, exposing it, working in the problem rather than in relationship to it. Again, returning to Serres' Parasite, what he suggests is that through the agency of pest or mixing it, there is the potential for a minor language to gain influence within a broader public discourse. So I'm just going to end up by asking Mick a question. It's a fairly crude question, but it's a question that I'm kind of curious about in relation to some of the things that Mick's been talking about. It's in relation to Support Surface, which emerges as a type of post-colour painting, post-colour field painting, historically aligned to the violent and politicised situation of Paris in 1968, I think. But in terms of its connections with writers and philosophers, Derrida, and its adoption of the deconstruction as a methodology, unlike, say, Arte Povera, which foregrounds significance and materiality, or in Brazil, Helio Oetica and Ligia Clark's constructions and social interventions. Against the violent federal background of Paris, SS produced an approach of painting that could be interpreted as insular to the point of being hermeneutic, and as such, instead of destabilising the architecture of power, that is, the institution actually becomes more reliant upon it. And I don't know, Meg, if it's appropriate, but I know you're very knowledgeable of that whole background.
Well, actually, with that whole period, Buren, with the Buren Mosset Parmentier Turoni, was actually they showed in 67 in the Biennale in Paris, and they were more linked to revisionist Marxist ideas, basically, with Althusser. That's the relationship to Althusser. Support Surfass comes later, and of course the Maoist aspect as well. But I think two things. Buren actually did become the he did become absorbed into the institutions, certainly not just in France, internationally, obviously. Big shirt the Guggenheim recently. Support Surfass never did. They just disappeared into the provinces, really, and they dropped off the map completely. And actually, in those years, which were the Pompidou years, it was Nouvelle Realisme, which people like Armand César were the official artists. And actually, where there was also, I can't remember the name of the artist now, it's gone, but there was a lot of artists who were using film. They were the ones who were part of that project, and that project was to, in a sense, figure this sort of technological moment of modernism, which really Pompidou was very, very consciously, culturally producing. But the hermetic aspect, I think, is true. I think what that comes out of is a very, and for people like Desires, Daniel Desires, it's a very close reading of Althusser, where in a sense they're thinking of ideology as material, and that ideology is a product of things being passed through structures. So their relationship to structure, especially, this is where they mobilise the term tableau, because it's at the level of the visual where, in a sense, what Althusser would say, obviousness occurs, that which you don't question, where you have to, in a sense, dismember it. You have to take it apart. So, I mean, I'm sorry, I've talked too much.
Well, I was just going to say is that, because I want to just return, because both of you have given quite, sort of, really quite dense and very, very good kind of papers. But I want to kind of return to this, in a sense, Richter is still this kind of stalking horse or something, because in your paper, he is still the one that actually, well, I mean, he was a jolt to our system, no doubt about it, a brilliant jolt to our system. But also, he's the one that actually reminds us that this notion of what it is you bring in, you know, that in fact it is in the end photographic, filmic, in a way, you know, this history is the politics that it's the broader bringing back into the process. He's still very central, and I can't imagine Elkins can have anything to say about him whatsoever, which is a good thing in my mind, because there's no way you can romanticise about that.
No.
It's brought centrally into something which is kind of hard to configure, but actually disturbs, at least I think it did when we first. But would that be the case with somebody like Anton Hennings now? Are we disturbed against somebody in that kind of?
I think coming into an installation of, say, Anton Hennings, that you would be maybe not disturbed but disorientated to an extent that you might be kind of confronted with a certain set of visual stimuli that come from different spaces. That's what I'm kind of talking about, that they are not, there's no kind of hierarchy within those between painting and film documentary and interior design, let's say. So there's a kind of overlapping there. And painting, in a sense, in his work, the way I read it, is it has to you know, it's not the centre of the work, it's only one component within a bigger set of possibilities.
Yeah.
So I think there is. I mean, I think the thing with Richter is it becomes such a kind of iconic painting figure of the 20th century, but it's difficult to see other things in comparison to that. But I think there's still a possibility to be surprised by things and to rejig your kind of thinking in terms of the image and in terms of painting in relationship to other things.
The reason I put him in there was I'm not that close to Richter as an artist, but he was very good at opening up these models, these mechanisms, the dispositive. I think that was absolutely fundamental. And actually, there's a recent book about the Atlas, and Buclo writes one of the essays, and the Atlas probably is the major aspect. And actually, the reason I put in the Bader Meinhof paintings was that what they're working with as material, in a way, Althusserian way, is the discursive spaces of the images. And I think, I'm not sure how successful they are in one sense, but that conversation that Buclo had with Richter, where Buclo keeps saying, these are political, coming back to what you're saying, but Richter's saying, no, they're not.
But he's,
yes. I think there's something that hinges on that he's not interested, I don't think, in the political, there's an obvious political content, he's interested in the discursive space, simply.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a very short time for maybe just one question if anybody's burning to ask. But we can return, I think, hopefully, the panel discussion, we can return to some of these kind of quite complicated issues. Maybe it's a need to digest at this point. Okay, well...
I forgot to say one thing,
yes,
actually.
Yes, please do. Yeah.
I'd like to end up by saying, I suppose I'm not really quite ready to commit to being strictly a painter.
I know that you can't say that.
I forgot that.
Okay, thank you very much. We've now got a very, very strict half hour break to go out and get coffee.
Oh, great. No.
I don't have much work. I mean, I've been reading you. I'm finally going to go
home. Yeah, so have I.
And I don't know.
I thought I had to do it. I thought it was necessary to do it because,